Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and tonight we continue our semi-structured journey around the various cup competitions, this time arriving on the English domestic shores with the League Cup, or by its rebranded name, the EFL Cup. With countless changes of sponsorship and even different types of trophies, the tournament has been a part of the English football calendar for nearly 60 years now, within which time it's been loved and scorned in equal measure. From the early years when many clubs opted not to take part, through its 1970s and 80s heyday, to an era where the top clubs gave it a near scant regard during the 1990s, before onward to a rebirth of sorts beyond the dawning of the new millennium. The League Cup has been a stepping stone to greater successes for some. It has arguably changed the course of a few clubs' histories, while it has remained elusively out of reach for other clubs. Traditionally, probably called known as the ugly sister to the FA Cup, tonight we're going to discuss the past, the present and the future of the Football League Cup. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of the ugly sister of English football's domestic trophies, I would just like to introduce my intellectual counterparts for this discussion. So first of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
All good, Stu, apart from the omnipresent man flu that simply will not go away.
Yes, I was just, on behalf of the nation, I was actually just going to ask how is said man flu?
I think it's week five now, war of attrition. You know, it's come back, yeah. 2 days ago, I thought it's on the way out. It's not. It's come back and kicked again.
I think we might solve Brexit quicker than you might get rid of this.
It's now exactly. I think it's having an extension of its own.
Okay, wow. We might have to extend Article 50 of your man flu.
Yes.
Okay. Hopefully, a slightly simple answer. Gary, how are you? Obviously, flu proof, as we know where you live.
I'm much better than poor old Stevie by the sound of it, yeah, so I'm good to go, matey.
Excellent. And then finally, Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Stu. Glad to report that I'm not suffering any effects from man flu. Probably just the fact that I spent 4 years in Leeds, that may be super resistant to the cold.
I think Stephen is suffering all of flu. I think he has all of flu for all of the country, for all of the people. I don't think there is any flu anywhere else. Right, OK, so let's get cracked on then with the League Cup. So, Paul, I'm going to come to you first. If you can, obviously for some of our younger listeners, if you can just sort of fill us in on the sort of the origins, really, of this hybrid trophy, I suppose, if you want to call it. It's had different guises, it's had different formats, it's had multiple winners, it's had different structured finals, it's had different trophies, but if you can just give us a little bit of the sort of the origins of the competition and how it came into being for us.
Yeah, happy to do that, Stu. So, I mean, just before the competition started, I mean, it wasn't an original idea because Scotland had the League Cup competition since the end of the Second World War, since 1946. But what kind of prompted the discussion about it in England in particular was the decline in attendances. So 1948-49, I think the aggregate attendance in England was about 42 million. By 1956, it had gone down to 33 million, so it had gone down by almost 25%. And the secretary of the league at the time, Alan Hardy, was looking for ways to try and draw crowds back in and to try and ease fixture congestion as well. A plan called the Pattern for Football. And his original idea was to have five divisions of 20 clubs and invite eight of the leading non-league teams to make up the hundreds and get the five divisions that way. Now, he was concerned that might cause a loss of revenue for teams, which obviously all the chairmen were very concerned about. So he proposed this other competition, the League Cup. And its original idea was it would be a pre-season competition, build up interest in the league before the season started, generate extra income for the clubs, and that's the proposal he went to. He went to the Football League chairman with, expecting their support. However, he didn't get that support. The league chairman just did not like the idea of five divisions of 20 clubs. They didn't like the idea of losing the income from two extra home games. But, bizarrely enough, they quite liked the idea of the League Cup. And instead of reducing fixture congestion, it actually added to it. So the league chairman decided, yes, they liked the idea of a League Cup, but they wanted it to be played midweek. They wanted it over two legs all the way through the competition. And Hardik a kind of situation where what he proposed originally was not going to go through, but he was left with a competition that he'd only proposed to reduce fixture congestion. And here he was now with a competition that was going to be in a format in a way he hadn't even considered or designed it to be. So it was quite bizarre how the whole thing started. And of course, not every club chose to enter the League Cup when it first started. So I think in the first year of the competition, 60-61, 87 out of 92 starts, which all things considered wasn't too bad. But three or four seasons down the line, it had gone to 47 clubs were entering the competition, and it really did look as though the competition was going to struggle to survive in that concept. So the press at the time was scathing about it. I mean, I think Brian Glanville referred to it as the League Cup, that massive irrelevance. And, you know, he had quite a word, Glanville, about things like that. And the one good thing about the competition that then was, and I think we might talk about this a bit later, was the cup itself. It was a really unique cup. And it wasn't a new cup. It wasn't an original cup. Apparently, he'd been languishing in a cupboard in Tyneside for a long period of time. And it used to be competed for between the Tyne shipyards for like a competition to see who had the best shipyard team on the Tyne, as indicated by the name. And the league president, Joe Richards, heard about this cup, bought it, had his name inscribed upon it, and creates that unique cup that we have now with the three handles on it. His name is still on the cup. I think it says presented by Joe Richards or something like that on the base of the cup as well. It was known in the press as Hardacre's Folly because people just didn't see the point of it. Big teams like Everton, Liverpool, Man United, Tottenham, etc. didn't participate in the early years of the competition. But the one thing that saved the League Cup from being a total irrelevance was moving the final to Wembley. So in 1967, for the first time ever, the League Cup final was held at Wembley in front of 97,000 fans. And when you think the previous League Cup final over two legs between West Brom and West Ham had a combined total of about 62,000, it was massively for interest. It then moved to 3 o'clock on a Saturday, although bizarrely enough, there was a full league fixture taking place that day as well, but the League Cup still went on. It wasn't live on TV, but when the highlights were shown that evening, it was one of the most dramatic finals you could ever ask to watch. Third Division QPR coming back from 2-0 down to be First Division West Bromwich Albion to win the League Cup. So in terms of a showpiece for the new new venue for the competition, it was absolutely perfect. And as Brian Glanville reluctantly had to say at the end of his match report, as pseudo events go, it wasn't half bad.
Brilliant. An outstanding early potted history of the tournament. Gary, the two-legged final, you know, before we sort of, you know, bring it up to that, as Paul mentioned about Wembley, you know, the two-legged final, what are your thoughts and opinions on I suppose, the benefits of a two-legged final? Because obviously it didn't really have a chance to get going. And to be fair, Paul's argued very well about taking the final to Wembley and, you know, the increase in attendance. But what do you think about the two-legged final?
Well, it's pretty interesting what Paul said earlier about the plan was to reduce fixtures and end up increasing them. And two-legged games, two-legged ties right the way through to the final was obviously something that would bring in more revenue for clubs. And even in those days, when we're talking early 60s, 1961, the first competition, as Paul said, money was still a big factor in football. And the people who made the decisions wanted more games to bring in more revenue. What it did, though, was it diluted there wasn't a showpiece for him, there wasn't a crunch decision. He played over two legs, which I guess is fine. You know, you get the chance to go to and support your own team at home. But that wasn't that showpiece final. And until, as Paul said, 1967, when it moved to Wembley, it didn't have that cachet. And it still has got the cachet of the FA Cup, which far more, it's far less different now because they play a one-off final than they did playing two legs. Two-legged finals are a bit sort of a bit dated, even the old UEFA Cup that played across two legs in the past, and those are the things where things have gone now because it doesn't have that that magnificence of a one-off occasion of a cup final where it's a win or lose situation.
Yeah, you're right. There's so much drama, isn't there, in a one-legged final or a one-off game final. Stephen, if I can just come to you before we sort of take the tournament on a little bit. There was also, in preparation for this, because I have to know a little bit, even though you guys know everything. there was also it sort of coincided with the floodlights and the sort of the introduction of evening games, which as we both know, games under floodlights bring a whole different dynamic and a whole different feel to the, to the game. Do you think? I suppose that the fact that it was played on an evening under the lights, the ties. Do you think that had it been played on a weekend or at normal kickoff times, do you think it probably would never have got going, or do you think the floodlight element to it perhaps saved it in those early days?
I think it probably did. Games through the winter months, something to go and watch in the midweek, under the floodlights. There is something. There is something great about going watching a League Cup tie under the floodlights. Sometimes even in a half-filled stadium, there's especially as an away fan. If you're an away fan and you're travelling a great distance to go and watch your team in a League Cup third round match, I think I can remember going watching Liverpool on one particular run where I think we ended up having to go to Spurs, Watford, Crystal Palace, all in one season, and they're all like Tuesday and Wednesday night games, and you don't get home until 3 a.m, and if you get up to get to work at 8 o'clock, then you have very little sleep the next day. They're almost like a badge of honour, in some ways those wild away games. Yeah. But yeah, I think the floodlights and it just offered something different. And you've got to bear in mind as well that when the tournament came into being. And grew, that there wasn't the expanse of European games to compete with it, to flood it, to flood around it at the time. European games, you play two rounds before Christmas, an extra one in the UEFA Cup. So there wasn't that kind of blanket case of playing 7, 8, 9, 10 games in Europe before Christmas. So these games were welcome attractions.
Yeah, they're almost like, I can remember going on, mini adventures, you would call them, that evening, that travelling in a car with friends or, like you say, a badge of honour is great, but they were like mini adventures, grounds you would probably never dream of going to. And they always look, grounds always look better at the night time under floodlights, no matter where you go.
They do, but if you can see the floodlights coming from a distance, then there's no finer sight than seeing that in a car, especially if you don't know exactly where the ground is.
And
you're looking for the floodlights. It's great. It's just one of those great aesthetics of football, and absolutely. I've adored my times watching the League Cup.
Paul, obviously I'll come back to you now. Sort of in the early days, obviously you had some, rare successes that you probably wouldn't get, within the FA Cup competition. So looking, in the early days with QPR and Swindon, who were both, sort of third division sides, actually winning one of the major trophies, or probably not considered as major as the FA Cup and the Football League Championship. But it was certainly an opportunity early on for clubs to actually gain some silverware and compete and, appear in those finals.
Yeah, it was a much more sort of open competition than what the FA Cup was. And even from when the competition first started in 1960-61, the first final was between Aston Villa and Rotherham United, who were then Division 2. And then the following season, the finals between Norwich City from Division 2 and Rochdale from Division 4. So it was actually quite an open competition in those days. And then you kind of had a period of where the Midlands clubs seemed to be dominating the competition. I think Birmingham won it in 63, Leicester won it in 64, I think, and then West Brom won it in 66. So it was a very Midlands sort of based trophy hall there, and it was spread amongst the teams there as well. And what was quite good there was in the first 7-8 years of the competition, none of the established big teams, such as, you know, Tottenham, Burnley, Everton, Liverpool, Man United, etc., weren't challenging, but, you know, weren't making progress in the competition because they weren't entering it. So it just made the whole thing much more open. I mean, Gary might agree with me that possibly the first big team to win the competition was Chelsea in 1965 under Tommy Doherty, when they, you know, they beat Leicester over two legs with, I think it was Eddie McCready scored the winning goal at Leicester, playing his centre-forward in a one-off role. And then after that, I think 1967-68 was the first sort of clash of the two biggest teams at the time, Leeds United and Arsenal. But going back to what you're saying about the underdogs, yeah, I mean, QPR lit up the competition by winning it in 1967 because it really drew national attention to the club as well. And what I meant to say before as well was the way tickets were allocated for the League Cup final meant that more supporters of the clubs could go and watch the final. Yeah. So therefore, the atmosphere was much, much better. I think at the time, allocation for the FA Cup final was 14,000 tickets per club. I think for the League Cup, it was about 30, 35,000. So that made a massive difference to the atmosphere at those finals as well. The QPR win, absolutely brilliant, you know, to come back from two down, to come back and beat the existing holders 3-2 at Wembley was just a fabulous result. The highlights were shown on TV later on that evening, so people did get a chance to watch that. And of course, the Swindon victory, you know, 2 years later against a team that was going to win the double in 1971, yep. Arsenal, have beaten them 3-1. In Arsenal's defence, you know, the pitch was a quagmire. I think they'd have the Horse of the Year show there on in the morning before the final, I think. The pitch was just awful, and in extra time, where you would have expected Arsenal to be the stronger and fitter team, Swindon Town, with a guy called Don Rogers, who had a glowing reputation at that time, absolutely ran Arsenal ragged. Scored two more goals in extra time, won the competition 3-1. And of course, the irony for both Swindon and QPR was, although a place in the First Cup and then the UEFA Cup was available to the winners, you had to play in the top division to take that place. So neither QPR or Swindon Town could actually take that place in Europe. And to try and compensate for that, the following year, they created the Anglo-Italian competition, which meant Swindon Town got a taste of Europe by quite a bizarre route.
Gary, I mean, how do you feel about Chelsea being identified as the first big side to win the League Cup?
Happy to take it. After watching performance last night when we lost 4-0 against Bournemouth, I'm happy to take any sort of compensation. But I mean, Paul's absolutely right, and the great fact about Eddie McCready, I was going to say it myself, Paul, but you were well done, buddy. You said about Midlands clubs. It's interesting that you know, as you said, Aston Villa won the first one. The second final was Norwich and Rochdale, which obviously wasn't Midlands. Then we had Birmingham against Villa, Leicester against Stoke.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, Chelsea then beat Leicester. Then the Baggies, West Brom, beat West Ham. Then QPR beat West Brom. And the Leeds-Arsenal final was one where there was no Midlands involved in 68. From 69, interestingly, in the Swindon-Arsenal game, people might think there was no Midlands representative, but there was. Because the referee was a guy called Bill Hadley, who came from Cannock in Staffordshire. So the Midlands representation was maintained for a while. And then after that, West Brom lost to Man City, then Aston Villa lost to Tottenham, then Stoke beat Chelsea. So, you know, a big Midlands run there. But I particularly remember the Swindon Arsenal final. The QPR. West Brom was the first one I can really remember well, but the Swindon one was a great game for the underdog as well. And Swindon were, but they played exceptionally well and should have won. And Bobby Gould equalised with about 4 or 5 minutes left to force extra time. Yeah. And then, as Paul said, Don Rogers, who was a starting winger, he got transferred to Crystal Palace, I think, afterwards.
He did.
scored twice in injury time, the last goal in the last minute of injury time. And we were talking with on a previous pod with Andy Summerton about Fiverr's commentary, as we remember, and David Coleman was commentating on the final, and Rogers broke clean. He ran the across the end of the pitch, went, I think he had round Bob Wilson or tucked it under him as he came out. And I remember Coleman saying, "And that is that." And it was, because time had run out, and it was 3-1 to Swindon. It's a fantastic final, and that particularly sticks in my mind.
Brilliant. It's funny, isn't it? You're right, you know, when we did the pod with regards to commentary and how almost commentary lines are almost like lyrics that can take you back to games and moments in games. Stephen, if I can just come to you, because we've sort of talked, briefly mentioned the Leeds United victory in sort of 68, but really for them, you know, they used, unlike Chelsea, they used the League Cup as a springboard, sorry Gary, as a springboard for a period of domestic dominance, didn't they? And some clubs have used that trophy in that competition to almost begin to assert themselves on the domestic game.
Yeah, they certainly did. I mean, they'd had a raft of near misses. They won promotion in 64-65, first season, up back in the first division. They lost out on the title on goal average. They lost the FA Cup final in extra time to Liverpool. I think they got to the FA Cup semi-finals again in 66. There was a lost first cup final in 67. So they had this, essence of being the Neely man. Yeah, in 68, they win the League Cup, they beat Arsenal in the League Cup final. And within a year, they've won the league title, a first cup has been won. And then all of that great era of the late 60s and up to the mid-70s for Leeds just rolls on and rolls on. But they needed that first initial success to give them that springboard to push them forward, and that's what they got. And they were arguably the first of a succession of clubs that did that, really, because you can look at the Aston Villa in 1975. They won from the second division under Ron Saunders, and we'll come to Ron Saunders in a little bit, but that win in 75 for Villa, they won again 2 years later, and it rolls on into them being league champions by 81 and European champions by 82. Nottingham Forest, how important that first win was in 78 for them before lifting the title that year. And then, the European Cups to come, they reached two, three successive finals, winning two, losing the last one. And there's been loads of instances down the years. Jose Mourinho's first major trophy for Chelsea was the League Cup. Liverpool winning the cup treble in 2001, that initial League Cup success against Birmingham, as hard-fought as it was in the end, was massively important in them going on to win the other two trophies. If they lose that League Cup final against Birmingham on penalties, then maybe they don't go on and win the FA Cup and the UEFA Cup that season. I think there was a really important League Cup win for Manchester United 2000s somewhere where was it possibly Ronaldo's first major trophy for them? And then they went on and had another spree of success. So there's these instances through through the competition where clubs have won it and then gone on to bigger and better things. I think it was Pep Guardiola's first trophy for Man City, a League Cup. I think that was possibly as well. But it's not just third as well. It has gone on to be a massively pivotal tournament for so many people and so many clubs.
Yeah, I'll just jump in there. I mean, I think Steve makes a fantastic point there that for a club who hasn't won a trophy for a while or even at all, the biggest step in the world is taking 0-1, and 1-1 million is like falling off a log after that. But once you get that winning, that knowledge, that experience of having crossed the line and got a trophy in the cabinet, It's amazing how easy, yeah, less difficult it's the second one to come along.
It's that sense that it's moorish then, you've got that sense of success and it instills in the players and they want it again and again and again, and it becomes, they become hooked to it and they want it more and more. Yeah. And it is amazing to look through, through the years and think, God, yeah, look at how they've won it there and it's gone on to, bigger and better things. But I'll just backtrack a little bit on we mentioned the fact that QPR and Swindon have won it from the third division. Aston Villa in 71, people might not realise that when they reached the final in 71 against Spurs, they played that final from the third division as well. They'd gone through two relegations and dropped to the third tier. And that final was arguably the genesis of the fight back, you know, from those depths to drop into the third division, devastatingly for them, but then to reach a League Cup final, lose it, but, you know, within 4 years, they're back in the first division, the League Cup winners, they started to look towards Europe, and they're building as a football club of purpose again.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Stephen. I mean, that was Vic Crowe, wasn't it, who was Villa manager at the time?
Yes.
Who started their climb back. I think they'll be recovering from Tommy Docherty's disastrous couple of seasons in charge, where he promised to get them out of the second division and took them down to the third division, so he kept his promise. But going back to things about Leeds United, that final, just two things about that game kind of stuck out in my mind. Apparently, before the game, Don Revie was going to take in an empty trophy case to show the Leeds players, you know, we haven't won anything yet. And he walked into the change room, he saw the players were so nervous before the game, he just scrapped that idea and put it away. And in the game itself, it was the first example of the famous Leeds tactic of putting Jack Charlson to stand in front of the goalkeeper on the goal line. And Leeds' goal came directly from a corner that the Arsenal defence just couldn't deal with. And I think it was Terry Cooper finished the move off to win Leeds' first trophy. And as you said, Stephen, and as Gary was saying before, it's the importance of winning that first trophy, because by the end of that season, they won the Intercity First Cup as well. So suddenly, from a club who was always the bridesmaid, suddenly, you know, they were the bride.
The competition, I suppose, really by the 70s, I suppose, had really sort of started to establish itself. I mean, Gary, you only have to look at Tottenham's sort of victories in 71 and 73, and you can start to see almost the seriousness with which it's now being taken by the bigger clubs.
Yeah, it's certainly by that time the competition took on an aura of being a pot worth winning. And European qualification obviously helped, but certainly the kudos of the Wembley final for fans, and as was mentioned earlier, you know, there's far more a far greater representation of the fans of the two clubs there than is available at the FA Cup, because the ticket allocation was so much better, and it almost became like a people's cup, for want of a it's a bit of old cliche, but there is that sort of element to it. And I think it became much more important as time went on. And through the 70s, as the larger teams began to take larger clubs, and I don't mean any disrespect to other clubs, but as the top clubs became more involved in taking the competition seriously, and so they reap the rewards of that. And as you go on through the 70s, and as Steve mentioned, Nottingham Forest and then Liverpool dominated it for a while. These were, you know, the teams that also won the European Cup. These were the big clubs that suddenly became more and more interested in what had been, as Paul mentioned earlier, a pot that nobody was particularly interested in.
There's a name I want to throw out in a minute, and I'm going to throw the name to Paul. But just before that, Stephen, you touched really briefly on the importance of it to Forrest and Brian Clough, and I think. Someone like Brian Clough realised, didn't he, the importance, and I think it was Gary mentioned it, getting that first trophy, getting over the line, was so important for what was to come in the next sort of 4 or 5 years of, again, not so much domestic dominance with only one league title, but certainly, you know, putting themselves as a European presence sort of came from the experience gained in that League Cup victory.
Yeah, completely. I mean, the fact that it was Liverpool who were playing in the final as well, you know, reigning league and European champions, you know, it was, as far as Clough and Forrest were concerned, it was the ultimate test. You know, here was the chance to, you know, push upon his own players of what they could possibly do. And it was two closely contested games, you know, goals drawn at Wembley, and Forrest edged the replay at Old Trafford with a very contentious penalty indeed.
Is that says you or says history?
VAR.
No,
I remember that. I have to back Steve up there. The photo of Thompson was clearly on John O'Hare. It was clearly outside the area.
In modern terms, Thompson would have walked. It was a professional foul.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and all that. But for its era, it was simply a free kick on the edge of the penalty area, probably a booking. It was similar to you might have seen it was a was it Willie Young in the FA Cup final against West Ham? A very, very similar incident where he just legged him up basically just outside the penalty area.
In that competition, presaged what a lot of clubs doing now, and he played a lot of reserves in that competition, and he called the team his virgins.
What he also had out there was that he signed Peter Shilton from Stoke City
and played Chris Woods.
But the thing was that Shilton was cup tied because he played first round for Stoke. So he had to, because the Stoke is his goalkeeper, he'd gone in part exchange to Stoke. So he had no option for that season. He had to play his no reserve keeper.
But there was others as well who weren't on the first team players.
But that's it. I mean, the importance of it was so massive for him, that first win. It just gave the confidence to say, well, look, we can close out, because at the time they were a good few points ahead in the title race. They were about 6 or 7 points ahead, but you are still within 8-9 weeks at the end of the season. And it would have been a case of, had they lost that final, that nagging doubt getting into the back of the players' minds during the running, so who knows what might have happened. But the fact that they won it enabled them to push on and take the title as they so deservedly did towards the tail end of the season, and comfortably by a decent points margin.
That's a really good point, because at the time Liverpool were reigning European champions, weren't they?
Yeah, Liverpool were reigning league and European champions.
That was a real statement, wasn't it?
It was, because if Liverpool had won that final, for instance, and then said, right, we've taken that off you, and now we're going to come and chase you down in the league.
Yeah, exactly. It would
have been a psychological, a proper test of nerve there.
But yeah, the fact
Forest win it, that confidence and saying, well, actually, we've won this. Why not? We can close out this league title. And they went on and did. And then 2 years of European success, another League Cup, and then eventually losing the final to Wolves in 1980. It was massive for Forest, that 1978 one.
I suppose a tangible link at best, but I'll do my best to try and link it together. When we're talking about the European Cup, and at that particular era, and we think of Forest and we think of Villa, and this is where I'm going. Ron Saunders, who didn't necessarily win the European Cup, but it was certainly his side that won the European Cup for Villa. But his relationship, Paul, with the League Cup was quite unique, almost, wasn't it, in terms of final appearances?
Oh yeah, I think as Gary mentioned before, he was continuing the Midlands tradition as well, and he got to four League Cup finals in 5 years, winning two of them, losing two of them with three different teams. So in terms of establishing your reputation as a big time manager, the League Cup was certainly was very, very useful to Ron Saunders in that respect. And also, I think the 77 League Cup win over Everton came at a crucial time for Saunders. I think he was under a bit of pressure in terms of where Villa were going, and certainly winning a trophy always buys you time, and also allows you to attract the better type of player as well. So certainly, if one man kind of set his mark on the competition in the 1970s, undoubtedly that would have been Ron Saunders. Can I talk about the 77 final while I'm here, Stu?
You can talk about whatever you want. Absolutely.
Okay, I want to keep it in the script, but
don't worry about that. I've ripped it up.
The 77 League Cup final against Everton, it is the longest ever domestic cup final. So it lasted three games. It took 330 minutes of football in three different stadiums. The aggregate attendance for the three matches was 205,000, which I think is a record for any game in any final in Britain. And when you think how bizarre the whole thing was, because the first final at Wembley didn't have extra time for reasons I don't understand. Just like the 83-84 final between Everton and Liverpool didn't have extra time, once again for reasons I don't understand. The second replay at Hillsborough, at the end of the game, nobody knew where the replay was going to take place because no one had envisaged that it might go to a third game because no domestic cup final had ever gone to three games before. So at the end of the match, they announced over the time, sorry, we don't know where the replay is going to be played. No, we will communicate the outcome in a few days' time. It took 4 weeks for the final replay to take place. So it was the most watched cup final. It was the longest cup final. And it was the most drawn-out cup final as well. And at the end of all that, Everton lost anyway.
did you go to any of those, Paul?
I went to all of them.
Brilliant.
Because I went to one at Wembley, and then I was at Leeds at the time, so getting from Leeds to Sheffield wasn't too bad, and then the final replay was in Manchester. I think that was during our Easter holiday, so yeah, went to all three, as did lots and lots of other people. I think we worked out that Everton Villa fans probably travelled 600 miles to see the three games between them, which is just absolutely bizarre now when you think about it.
Brilliant. I suppose we've kind of sort of covered the 70s, and the big names and the big teams and what it meant for some clubs. Sorry, yeah, go on.
Stu?
Yeah?
Gary wants me to talk about the Stoke final.
Well, tell him no. Yeah, that's fine.
They're all hard, Paul. They're all hard. there was Chelsea who had just come back from winning the FA Cup 70, Cup Winners' Cup 71, and playing Stoke in the League Cup final. But the team not too dissimilar from the one who had just triumphed in Europe, and that fully expected to win. But Stoke, on the day, Stoke with a better team, and away you go, Paul.
Okay, well, I'll try and be as sympathetic as possible here. So, I mean, Stoke in the semi-final had four games against West Ham to get to the final. And it was level over two legs. The first replay ended in a draw. The second replay, I think, was at Old Trafford. And if you recall, Bobby Moore had to go and goal for West Ham because West Ham goalkeeper got injured, I think it was Bobby Ferguson. He actually saved the penalty, but unfortunately, Stoke scored from the rebound, and that was the decisive goal to take Stoke through to the final. So it's quite bizarre, Bobby Moore actually saving a penalty. But then, as you said there yourself, Gary, I think Chelsea were massive favours to win that competition. And if I can just digress a little, I think when Arsenal won the double, they brought out that record good over Arsenal. But the Chelsea song, Blue is the Colour, was actually recorded for the 1972 League Cup final. It's kind of so confident they were at a victory. And they were actually in the top of the pop studios doing a live performance. And allegedly, when they did the first take, it wasn't very good. And given the people there, that's no surprise, really. And Eddie McCready said to the floor manager, "Look, we need to have a few drinks before we can get in the mood for this." So they ordered, apparently, about four crates of beer and a few bottles of vodka, went back at night time, did it again, and allegedly that was a much, much better version. But Blue is the Colour.
I should mention that with that, Paul, that Blue is the Colour is the highest ranking in the top charts of any football club's recorded song. We've got to number three. No club got higher than number three or equal number three. So that's one distinction they got, even though they lost the final.
But even come back on that, 2 years...
No!
The following year, when Tottenham got to the final, they recorded a nice one, Cyril, with the Cockerel Chorus, and the songwriter of that song won the Ivor Novello Comedy Song Award as a prize. So not only did Tottenham have a chance hit and won the cup, but they got an award for it as well with their record.
Chelsea kept their comedy on the field, mate.
Brilliant.
I'll just throw into that is that I think the interesting thing about that Chelsea defeat there is that we've spoken about the League Cup being a springboard to success. It's not always the case. I mean, you look at Chelsea's struggles after that up until the mid, well, into the 80s, really, for the next decade. It kind of stems from there, really. It all starts to unravel, quite categorically for them, that, building of a huge main stand that they built that was such a weight around the club's neck for so long. you know, they were relegated by 75, I think it was. They were relegated again before the 70s had finished. You know, and they didn't flourish as a club again for a good decade, you know, after that League Cup final loss to Stoke. So it can work in a reverse kind of manner. You know, it's not always about the springboard. It's almost like an anti-springboard in a way. I don't know what an anti-springboard
just
would be, but
just a plank.
Whatever it was, it's walking a plank. Isn't it? Yeah. maybe I think the League Cup possibly has no finer example than that particular Chelsea side and what came after that 72 final.
You're right. The cloud had already set in because Sexton had already gone by this time, and Burtonshaw was the manager when they got to the final. As you say, they lost, and the team was in decline. It was a fairly old team by this stage, and they did get relegated. And it wasn't until John Neil came to Stamford Bridge that the renaissance of the club actually took place. And when Bates bought the club, and all of a sudden, you know, they had the right guy in the right place who could bring the club back again. But you're right; it was a big marker on their precipitous drop after European glory.
And there was such a talented team as well, Gary. When you think that they had Osgood there, they had Hudson, was only about 22 at the time. He should be at the peak of his form. You know, I know Charlie Cooper was getting on a little bit. I mean, Benassi, McCready, those players through the 60s were starting to slow down.
But McCready didn't play that game. Paddy Mulligan and Ron Harris played as fullbacks. John Collins was still there. Alan Hudson, as you mentioned. Chris Garland had just come into the team. Peter Harrison, Charlie Cook, as you said,
I think I think I'm going to rename this pod Chelsea. Where did it all go wrong? I feel like you've got tricked tonight, Gary.
Every year,
Steve. if I could just bring this up. Obviously, I'm going to start with you, Stephen, in the 80s for obvious reasons. I'll chat to Paul and Gary about sort of the rebranding of the League Cup, if you like, during the 80s, which was something in itself. But to begin with, obviously, the 80s, you know, you can't look much further, one, than Liverpool, and two, the white ball with the red panels that went all the way around, which is still one of my most favourite footballs of all time.
Yeah, that's one of the most iconic balls going, that one. Certainly 81 and the 82 finals that I remember watching Liverpool with it, and it's the way it's spun.
Yeah, I was just about to say it's
that distortion of it as it spins. It was just a work of art, and the League Cup was such an oddity, you know, in that respect. You know, I think of one of the most beautiful, aesthetically beautiful trophies, that three-handled League Cup trophy. But the fact that, you know, medals weren't handed out to the winners until 1982. Up until then, the winners got a tankard. It was a winner's tankard. It was this silver tankard, you know, and it was just one of those great quirks. It was a proper quirky kind of tournament at the time. But yeah, moving into the 1980s, you know, that essence of kind of, you know, the big teams really went for it. You know, it really had taken off. It had taken flight. You know, Wolves won in the 1980, and it completed the medal haul for Emlyn Hughes. The only thing he'd not won at Liverpool was essentially the League Cup, and he won it as the Wolves captain in 1980, you know, ending that Forest dominance. But then on comes Liverpool, and we win it. It's still to this day the only instance of a domestic English major tournament being won four times in succession. You know, 81 to 84, Liverpool were imperious in the competition. It started quite badly, actually, because that 80-81 run, Liverpool played Bradford City, a fourth division Bradford City at the time, in the second round, or was it the first round? I can't remember if the big team skipped the first round back then, but played Bradford, and it was over two legs, went to Valley Parade, lost 1-0. And it was an epic result, you know, for Liverpool, nice Liverpool to be losing to fourth division Bradford City. Corrected it the second leg, went off and won it. But what I would point to is the calibre of the teams that Liverpool beat in the final over those years. You know, yes, West Ham were a second division side, but were the FA Cup holders. It was a West Ham who were sweeping the second division aside, heading back to promotion. It was the West Ham of Brookings and Bond, It was, it was Phil Parks in goal, who at one point, you know, West Ham signed him as a second division side. He was the most expensive goalkeeper in the world, you know. And then it was the Spurs of Hoddle and Archibald and Ricky Veer and Ardiles. It was the Manchester United of Ron Atkinson, Brian Robson. It was Arnold Muren. It was all of those. And then it was Everton, you know, the first all Merseyside final in 1984. So, you know, the calibre of those sides that Liverpool took on and won were massive. And those finals were huge. And I think it started to propel the tour because, like Paul said earlier on, the final used to take place on a Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock kickoff. It wasn't, you know, live on television. That first live League Cup final broadcast was the 1984 final between Liverpool and Everton. The 1981 final replay between Liverpool and West Ham at Villa Park was live on television. But as far as a Wembley final, it was only from 1984 that the television companies deemed it, you know, worthy to put on. Even the fact that it had been a Liverpool Man United final the year before. But it was, they were all great games with massive drama in them. That 1981 final, there was, you know, a very late contentious goal that Liverpool scored. Not contentious by modern day standards, but at the time, it shouldn't have counted. Sammy Lee was injured in an offside position. The goal would be given nowadays without a blink, but at the time, it shouldn't have been. But then West Ham equalised for a penalty at the very end, with virtually the last kick of the game to take it to the replay. Liverpool had to come from behind in the replay to win it. The 1982 final against Spurs, Liverpool came to within 3 minutes of losing it, got an equaliser and then swept it in extra time. Again, came from behind against Manchester United in the 1983 final, took it into extra time and won it with spectacular goals. And they were just very dramatic and very, you know, high-profile games. And at the time, those League Cup finals as well, and no disrespect, because the FA Cup had that brilliant drama to it, and the fact that the underdogs were rising to the occasion. But you look at kind of like the 1980 final, for instance, when Wolves and Forest played each other, a big game for a tier second division. West Ham had reached the final, and Liverpool played Tottenham in the 1982 League Cup final. QPR were an FA Cup finalist, you know. So these teams that, you know, in a way, the League Cup finals that were being played at that time were almost, there were bigger head-to-heads than the FA Cup final. It was the lesser tournament, but it had the competitors had the names in lights as such, you know, compared to kind of like the FA Cup final. It was nuts.
As well, Stephen, it goes about, you were saying before about the League Cup being a springboard for clubs as well. I think you could make the case that although Everton lost the 1984 final, it was the springboard for Camden to go on to. Getting to the final was a springboard as well.
Hugely, hugely important to Everton. It was. It's not always a case of winning it. You know,
exactly. Yeah.
You know, I'd take Rafa Benitez as part of that as well. He reached the 2005 final with Liverpool and won the Champions League a few months later. So, you know, it isn't always about winning it. It can be, you know, a pivotal game partway through the tournaments. You know, Kendall was under massive pressure.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
Time and although, you know, it's not the, you know, the legend is that the Oxford win saved him, but, you know, there were other games. But it was, I think that was massively important in Everton's regeneration and the push forward as a force in the mid-80s.
Yeah, and I think it's where you could also argue when Arsenal won the League Cup in 1987, that was almost kind of the launch pad for them, for the George Graham era as well. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, Stephen, the 87 League Cup final, was that the first time that Ian Rush had scored for Liverpool and Liverpool didn't win?
Yes, it was. Throughout his entire career up until that point, 6 years worth of goal scoring for Liverpool. You know, Ian Rush scored and Liverpool never lost. And he opened the score in that game about 10 minutes in. And as far as kind of like everyone was concerned, well, that's it, done and dusted. Liverpool can't lose this game, but they did. It happened again a week later, I think. I think he did exactly the same thing at Norwich City or something like that. and it had not happened for years and years and years, and then it happened a couple of times in short succession.
I suppose, Gary, I mean, listen, obviously, Steve's almost like he works for the League Cup. Listening to him wax lyrical about the League Cup in the 80s, I mean, and then all of a sudden we have, you know, it becomes the Milk Cup, it becomes the Littlewoods Cup, the Rumbelows Cup, you know, and so it goes on. And do you think that maybe people saw an opportunity, you know, with these bigger finals? And Stephen's right, to be fair, you know, there were great games. I can remember them as a kid, the great games, great finals. You know, do you think that, I suppose, not the start of commercialisation, but do you think that was where companies took it upon themselves to see the benefits of maybe being associated with tournaments?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. In fact, the last non-sponsored cup, League Cup, I think it was 1980 when Wolves beat Forest. I was there. My wife's family, all Wolves fans, and I was there, and we were behind the goals when Dave Needham chested the ball past Shilton and Andy Gray tapped into the empty onion bag. And that was the last time for a while that it hadn't been sponsored, because from 81 to sorry, the 82 final to 86 final, we had the Milk Marketing Board, became the Milk Cup, and that was succeeded by the Littlewoods Cup and the Rumbelows Cup and the Coca-Cola Cup, and so on and so on. After Milk Beer got involved with Worthington and Carling, and then there was Capital One, and then we got the Carabao Cup. There was one season when it wasn't, which was the 2016-17 season, but that was the only one. And obviously, there was a pathway to get sponsors into sponsoring major English football. Obviously, now we look at the Premier League, which carries a sponsor's name. We look at the FA Cup, it carries a sponsor's name. The League Cup was the first one that went down that track, and the Milk Marketing Board, it looked a strange thing now. I remember at the time it was deemed to be sort of semi-acceptable because milk was a healthy product, and Indeed. You know, there was a sort of acceptable thing, and it was a government organisation, it wasn't a private organisation. But it did open the door for others to follow, and then, as I said, Littlewoods followed, and then Rumbelows for some strange reason, and then Coca-Cola, Worthington, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, it is a very iconic trophy, Paul, isn't it? You know, you talked about it and where it came from and its origins, which was fascinating. But then all of a sudden you had these different guises of trophies. I mean, I can remember the Littlewoods Cup was huge. It was almost like a mace. You know, it was almost top heavy.
It was.
Yeah, it was like a big, massive novelty-sized goblet. I've half a vague memory that when Luton won it, and that is for me one of the great cup finals of all time. I'm sure they broke the trophy. They dropped it and broke. Yeah,
I think you're right, Stevie. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Because I mean, obviously, Paulie, you know. You know, we talk about Liverpool's dominance, but you know, just touched on it there, you know, with Luton and Oxford, you know, the competition, and with Wolves at the start of the decade, it still had the potential, didn't it, to throw up surprise winners and, you know, put football clubs on the map, albeit briefly for Luton and Oxford. But, you know, they were there.
Yeah, that's right, Stuart. I think, you know, there's one thing that's quite unique about the League Cup as well, because if you think in the year 2000, Tranmere Rovers got to the final as well, and that makes the League Cup the only domestic trophy that all three teams from Merseyside have made the final of.
I see.
Yeah.
There were
more oddities as well. There's like Norwich and Sunderland, the 85 finalists,
that's
and both
right, yeah,
relegated
yeah.
at the end of the season.
It had
these great little quirks and oddities to it. Oxford's win when QPR were the raging favourites for it.
It just
threw up kind of like loads of. I don't know if it was more like a case of people would relax, teams would relax going into the League Cup because it was the League Cup. You know, as my team win the League Cup has always been great. But it's one of those that watching your team lose the League Cup doesn't hurt as much as losing anything else. And it sounds blasé, but you know, it offers it, you know, an interesting kind of position within the football calendar.
Yeah, I'd agree, Steve. I mean, because you think when you lose a League Cup final, it generally tends to be March, February, March time. So you have actually got a large chunk of the season to get over it. When you lose the final, it's invariably at the end of the season. So you've got all summer to dwell on defeat. So I think the timing of the final is excellent. And going back to what you're saying there about the teams that have won us, I mean, for certain clubs, it has been their only major domestic honour. I mean, it certainly is the case for Swansea. I think it's the case for Birmingham City. I think it's the case for Stoke. I'm pretty sure it's the case for Oxford, similarly for Norwich City as well. So for a number of clubs who, you know, maybe have never even got to an FA Cup final, the League Cup has offered them a chance of a trophy. And they, you know, that their fans, you know, will live on that glory, you know, for the rest of their lives, probably, because they may not get that chance again. I think Middlesbrough is their only trophy as well. So for a number of clubs to win the League Cup really means something to the town that they come from as well. And although, you know, certain high-profile managers might sort of downplay the significance of winning the League Cup, for the supporters of teams that haven't got a chance of winning the Premier League or the FA Cup, to win the League Cup is still a big thing.
Yeah, oh, it is. But I mean, we talk about that springboard concept as well for players. You know, that Oxford United side in 1986 had John Aldridge in it and Andre Anthony.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, that Luton side, you know, was a fine side. You know, but and the complexities of that Luton victory was that, you know, everyone was stunned by the win and the dramatic nature of the win. But at the time, Luton were, you know,
I think at the time, because the Luton chairman was, he banned away supporters for league games. He introduced the ID cards concept as well, and he's a big supporter of Margaret Thatcher. So at the time, Luton were a bit of a club that weren't liked by the rest of the establishment, by the rest of the footballing fraternity.
That's right. But then they supplied this, you know, iconic cup final moment.
Yeah.
And I think the problem part of that as well, that was that, not the problem part of that, but the converse part of it, is that so many of those players were being likable. You know, Brian Steen was a great player, and Ricky Hill, and these are given so much time and energy to Luton Town when, you know, they probably could have gone on elsewhere, and they did. They went and played in France beyond this win. It was like, we've done that for you now. We've carried you back to the First Division. We've kept you there. Now it's our turn to go and have our moments in, you know, in the sunshine. And
that's a fair point, Steve.
Not begrudge those great players the moments.
No, of course not.
And I think that was the complexity of it, that you did have this kind of like anti-Luton stance that so many of us had. But the respect for those players and the way that they won it, you know, kind of offset that.
It's interesting to hear the guys talking about these clubs who had a chance to win the trophy, and particularly the Rumble Owls Cup era, because 1991, when Sheffield Wednesday beat Manchester United, was the last time a non-top tier team had won the trophy. So there's a real sort of marker in the sand there that the clubs who had sort of come through, who wouldn't otherwise have perhaps won a trophy. You know, other teams got to the final, you know, and we mentioned Middlesbrough and Tranmere and Birmingham, who were non-top-tier teams. But teams that won it, no team outside the top tier has won that trophy since 1991. So this is we talk about when teams took the bigger clubs, took the trophy more seriously. I think that's almost like a line drawn in the sand there.
It's funny, actually, because I was... Go on, Paul, you're right.
No, you can't see
it. All I was going to say was, it's funny, you know, talking, you know, you've talked about lines drawn in the sand and teams taking it seriously, and then it's sort of, but then it coincides with the, I suppose, the explosion of the Champions League, and as Steve mentioned, you know, earlier, the, you know, the minimum fixtures with the European Cup was just about to change with regards to the Champions League, and you almost conversely have the very top sides starting to field weakened teams, or maybe putting it as a fourth priority or a third priority, and yet still that didn't provide an opportunity, like you've just said, Gary, for, you know, for some of the smaller clubs to actually take advantage of that. I mean, I don't know what, you know, what you guys think, but it certainly seems to coincide.
With regard to that, Stuart, it's interesting to note that since 2005, so we're looking until completed finals till last year, and they've done 14 finals, three of them won by Chelsea, four by Man United, three by City, one by Spurs and one by Liverpool, the others being Birmingham and Swansea. So 12 of those 14 finals have been won by teams you would consider part of the big five, six clubs. And this year, because City or Chelsea and Chelsea are in the final, it's going to be 13 out of 15 finals. So although clubs have been filled in weaker teams, when it gets towards the important parts of the semi-finals and finals, they still take this seriously. And as I say, looking at the teams that have won it over those past 14 years, 15 years if you count this year as well, it's still the top teams who are there. It's the top five or six teams. So, you know, aside, we're taking together Chelsea, Man United and Man City, they'll have won it between them 11 times.
Yeah, that's right, Gary. I think it shows the way, with the Premier League teams having so much money poured into them, they've built their squads to such a massive extent now that they can put out a reserve team, they're still going to beat the majority teams outside the top division. And I think that the imbalance in squads has really led to the domination of the top tier teams in that competition.
Yeah, what those clubs do is that the gamble in the early rounds of the competition, and again, it'll go back to kind of like that essence I said earlier on as a supporter. You know, you are delighted when your team wins it. It's great to see your team win it. But if you lose in the League Cup, you know, you get over it pretty quickly. But within football and the teams themselves, it's similar. You know, if they go out at the third round or the fourth round, you know, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, never mind. But once they get to the quarterfinal games tend to be played in kind of like the midweek before Christmas, basically. It's usually kind of like around about somewhere between the 15th and the 20th of December, by which time the Champions League group stages are finished. So those teams, you know, if you're one of those big teams that we've all mentioned there as being the recent winners that Gary mentioned, you know, if they have navigated the group stage of the Champions League or the Europa League or whatever it is they're playing in, they know that they've got European football and what Europe will be for them into the new year. They also know that by the time Europe kicks off again, that they've probably only got the League Cup final to play, with the semi-finals being in January. So there is that eye of the needle, for those big clubs between kind of like mid-December and the end of January, where they do have that little bit of sway to say, no, let's go for it. And that's what they do, is if they get into the last eight, they think, right, now we've got this far, we play to win. You know, I'm not saying they don't play to win those early rounds, but they gamble in the early rounds with the teams that they select and the lineups that they go with, and that tends to be the way it goes.
Where do we sit, fellas? I mean, I'll start with you, Gary, I suppose, in terms of using it as a way to blood youngsters into the first team.
I think what Steve says is absolutely right. In the early rounds, all of the big clubs do put these younger teams out. I do think, actually, for any team that's, you know, that's any team is not going to win the league, who's not going to finish in the top four, you do wonder why these teams put out weakened teams. This must be the easiest trophy to win, or the less difficult trophy to win, shall we say. None of them are easy. But if you want to run at winning a pot for your club, and you're a mid-ranking Premiership team, surely the League Cup is the one to target. Bigger clubs are going to be involved, as Steve quite rightly says, in European competitions, perhaps. And if you can get through to that sort of later stages and the bigger teams have got European involvement, you've got a good chance. Why don't mid-ranking Premiership teams put first teams out, concentrate more on that? But I think the problem is, and I'm answering my own question here, is it's essentially in football, the answer to so many questions is money. And you probably get so much more money for finishing in ninth position rather than 10th position than you do for winning the League Cup. So I guess that's the answer to the question. But I think it does give an opportunity for clubs to field younger and untried players. But I do wonder why, for the sake of glory, that so many more fans don't press their teams in the mid-rank of the Premier League to go for the League Cup.
Yeah, Gary, I totally agree with that. I mean, this season, you know, from my experience, watching obviously Marco Silva, you know, he starts out as a manager. When we had Southampton at home in the League Cup, everyone's thinking that this is our only chance of a trophy this season. It really is. Put the strongest team out. And when he puts out a weakened team, you could just feel, you know, bewildered from the fan base. Why are you doing this? And whether this is because managers who come into the Premier League from outside of the UK don't quite get the importance of the League Cup and they see it as an irrelevance, I don't know. But you're right, I totally support what you say there. I cannot understand why any Premier League manager would put out a weakened team at the early stage of that competition, because realistically, six good results and you're in the final.
Yeah, I mean, we had this Pochettino quite recently, didn't we, about, what did he say, trophies are for ego?
Yeah, but boost your ego, yeah.
I don't think fans would agree with that.
No, totally agree, Gary. Totally agree.
I mean, we're not going to know, and we're never going to be privy to a true answer to this. But certainly, obviously, with, you know, like you said, the Champions League sides, it's very much understandable with the, you know, with the blooding of youngsters. But with other clubs, I suppose, you know, Everton is a great case in point, Paul. You know, how do you think as players, really, if you have a decent career, you've probably got 15 attempts. If you have a 15-year career, yeah, you've done well. So you've probably got 15 attempts at the League Cup, 15 attempts at the FA Cup, 15 attempts at the league, but obviously that's as it is. But how do you think the players feel when the manager's almost striking one of those off? You know, he's taken away one of your 15 attempts. You know, do you think players are happy about it? Do you think there's resentment? I mean, you know, I know we're not going to know, but what do we think?
I would like to think there's a great deal of frustration. I'd like to think there's a great deal of anger of an opportunity being wasted to win a domestic trophy. Because to go back to Danny Blanchflower's famous quote, the game is about glory. You know, the game is about winning things. The game is about gathering trophies. And, you know, for a club like ourselves, Everton, we've gone 23, 24 years now without winning a thing. The League Cup is just a massive thing to go for. So I would have thought that most of the players in that, you know, regular first team is, when you see the team sheet going up saying you're not playing in this competition, you know, if I was there, I'd be banging on the manager's door saying, what the hell's going on here? This is my one chance of winning a contest with this club. So I'd like to think that most of the players would actually be quite frustrated by the stance taken by the manager. I mean, Gary made a really good point before about finances, that, you know, the League Cup doesn't maybe generate as much income as finishing 12th or 13th. But you would have thought, you know, even the owners of the club, the board, would be saying to manager, look, we haven't won a trophy for X number of years here. Right, field your strongest team and let's see how far we can go.
The problem is, Paul, I mean, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. The problem is that football clubs are run as businesses now, and brass trumps silver. Brass trumps silver every day.
Yeah, and the worrying thing to me is that there's a whole generation of younger supporters growing up now thinking that winning is not important. When Pochettino said the other day, the most important thing is for us to be in the top four and to win the Champions League, that goes against everything I go to watch football matches for. I don't go to watch Everton to see if it's eighth or ninth. I go to see us win a trophy, the League Cup, the FA Cup, whatever. No, I just don't buy into this. The top four is success. No, what's going to be next? No, open top bus parades when you finish in fourth position around the city centre. To me, it makes no sense whatsoever.
This is where we become four grumpy men.
Nothing wrong with us, Stu.
I was going to say, I'm fully, your answer was brilliant, Paul. It was exactly where I hoped you'd go with it. I feel exactly the same. I hope desperately that players are frustrated and that they want to play and they want to, you know, like we said, and Gary said, you know, money talks, you know, and it does talk. But for a player, it's, you know, you look back at your medals, you look back at your trophies, you look back at your, you don't look back at your, the number of times you finished in the top four. I would hope not, anyway, that you finished in the top four. It's
exactly,
it would exactly, drive me mad. It would absolutely drive me mad as a player. But, you know, I mean, I suppose, you know, time's against us as always. You know, we've sort of rattled through the League Cup, but I've got a couple of questions for all of you. One of them is to predict the winner on the 24th of February. So you might want to start thinking about, obviously not you, Gary, because as we know, it's a plank of a competition. But for everyone else, who do we think is going to win, apart from Chelsea? But before that, you know, League Cup memories. Like, you know, we've talked about it. It's been a strange competition. It's had quirks. It's been lambasted. It's been lauded. It's had everything, you know, as a tournament. And so, thinking about the tournament itself, I'm gonna ask you for your favourite sort of League Cup moment. Now, obviously, the person I ask first has the least amount of time to think. So I'm gonna go with Stephen first on this one. Favourite League Cup moment?
Oh, from a Liverpool perspective, the 82 final, comeback against Spurs, 3 minutes from losing, and you know, Ronnie Whelan and Ian Rush were the heroes that day. They were the young kids who'd been thrown in that season. And, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, I'd grown up with these legends of Liverpool, you know, McDermott, Kennedy, Case, you know, Souness, Dalglish, but that team hardly changed over my formative years. So then suddenly it was like Rush and Whelan were in there and they were younger kids and it was kind of like, wow. And they won that final. They made the difference to winning that final. And that was the one. And it had that ball in it. Stupid. Yeah. That ball.
Yeah. Oh, I remember. Don't worry. I love it. Absolutely loved it. Good choice. I like that. Paul, for you, favourite League Cup moment?
Yeah, well, if like Stephen did, I'll give like a personal account. So going back to that 1977 epic League Cup final against Aston Villa, the first replay at Hillsborough. And so I travelled down from Leeds, met my dad outside the ground. And in those days, when you're used to meet people outside the ground, you're willing, pushed your way through about 2,200 people trying to find the person you'd used to meet to get the tickets from them. And went to the ground, and Everton were getting beat 1-0. And there was a minute to go, and we looked across on the touchline, and the League Cup was being brought down to the touchline with claret and blue ribbons on it, ready to be presented to Aston Villa. And you can just imagine the anger and frustration from where we were. And then, as the cup was coming down, at the last minute of normal time, Latchford equalised for Everton. And I've never been so thrown so far up in the air as it was when that goal went in front of the Everton fans. So it was just absolute bedlam. And then, of course, but it went to extra time. The atmosphere was absolutely brilliant. And I remember getting the train back from Sheffield in the days when you could get trains at night time. I got a train back from Sheffield at 1:30 in the morning, got me back into Leeds at 2:15. On the platform, I met two other Everton fans who were also studying in Leeds, who lived about a mile away from me, and we just never met before for whatever reason, either in Liverpool or in Leeds. And then getting the all-night bus back from Leeds City Centre back to my accommodation in Leeds and getting to bed about 4:30 in the morning, but still getting up for lectures next morning. So it was just an absolutely brilliant day. I was great results, pity and so badly at Old Trafford.
Brilliant. Gary, you've got a tough act to follow, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, I'm going to be very unparochial. Chelsea have won the trophy 5 times, but I'm not going to go with the Chelsea game. I'm going to go back to 1969 when I was 12. And when Swindon beat Arsenal, and it was a great upset game. And Swindon came to Warsaw. I lived in Warsaw at the time, and we used to go to Warsaw regularly. I can't remember how long after, not long afterwards, to play at Warsaw. And the match of the day cameras or BBC cameras, wherever it was, were there. And Swindon beat Warsaw 3-0. And I remember watching Don Roger thinking, this is an exceptional footballer. And it's one of my earliest memories of football at Warsaw, but that game when Swindon beat Arsenal at Wembley in the League Cup final, that was romance. That was what football was all about for me, and it stuck in my mind for a long time. As I mentioned about Coleman's commentary when Don Rogers got the last goal in the last minute of injury time, of extra time as well. So I'll go with that.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant answers. Okay, so I'm going to start with you on the next one, Gary, because I'm assuming it's a pretty obvious answer, but. Winners on the 24th, Man City or Chelsea?
I can't see City not winning. We played. I mean, Chelsea's such a ridiculous team. We lost 4-0 to Bournemouth, but we beat Man City. We won away at Liverpool. We were beating Liverpool at home until Sturridge scored in the last minute, almost into injury time. This is typical Chelsea to go and beat City, but I can't see past City, to be truthful with you.
Oh, okay. Paul, where do you see the trophy ending up this season?
Okay, well, I'm actually going to go against what Gary said here.
Good luck.
I actually think Chelsea may win us, and my reason would be that I don't think the League Cup is a major priority for Man City. I think where Chelsea are now at the moment, in my opinion, Gary may agree or not agree, it's Chelsea's only realistic chance of winning a trophy. And I just think Chelsea will give everything to try and win that final, to win the trophy, because it could actually reignite what's left of their season in terms of a challenge to the top four place and maybe a longer run in the Europa League. So I think Chelsea got nothing to lose in this final. I think all the pressure's on City. And I just have a feeling that Chelsea, on the day, if the likes of Hazard, Barkley and people can perform to their standards, if they get an early goal, then it'll be every possibility of Chelsea sneaking a win.
Wow. I think Paul's just labelled Chelsea the Oxford United of this season, Gary. I'm not sure about that.
Pick the pot if I'm not learning.
Stephen, last of all, where do you think it's going?
I have a sneaky feeling for Chelsea as well. I do. Manchester City being pulled in four different directions, which is benefiting Liverpool at the minute, as far as the Premier League's concerned. And long may that stretching last. I'm quite happy for City to continue in the cup competitions for as long as possible. But yeah, I think Man City will win two trophies this season. They'll go twanging two tournaments, and this could be one of them. I do think Chelsea can relax a little bit going into it. There is pressure, but there isn't. And Manchester City just have such a difficult February. You know, in the next week they have an 8-day stretch where they play Arsenal, Everton, and who did they play at the end of the week? Did they play Chelsea in the league, or they have someone else at the end of that week? They play three because they have a bad time usually against Everton. Arsenal, and then there's someone else that they play at the end of that week. They have an 8-day span where it's a really difficult run of games. You know, you can throw in Champions League games starting again as well. And I know Chelsea are in Europe too, but I just think that is, you know, that League Cup final comes at the end of an arduous month, and I think Chelsea can pick it off.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Well, fellas, there we have it. Once again, an absolutely fascinating discussion with all three of you. We've managed to make this tournament actually sound like the greatest tournament in English domestic football. Considering we started off calling it the Ugly Sister, we've actually turned it into Cinderella. But
for our next trip, we'll do the same for the Zenith Escort.
Yeah. I was just about to say we'll do the Zenith Data System Trophy next, and we'll see what we can do with that.
Yeah.
Stephen, if you're going to do one more trophy, it's got to be the Super Screen Sports Cup.
Oh, yeah, the Screen Sports Super Cup. I was at that final as well. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll do the Screen Sports Super Cup beyond the ZPS Cup.
Oh, that should attract plenty of listeners, that one. As always, fellas, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure. Stephen, you know, thank you so much for your time and for joining us.
No problem. Joy as ever, Stu.
Brilliant. Gary, obviously, good luck for the 24th. You know, you might not have any confidence, but everyone else does, so you can kick back and relax.
Bless you, my friend. I would be delighted to be wrong about that, and it's been a great chat. Thanks.
Brilliant. And Paul, just as always, just an absolute pleasure to listen to and hear your knowledge and, you know, regaling us with tales of football gone by. It's, you know, as always, it's fascinating.
No, thanks, Stu. I mean, thanks yourself for hosting the programme. You've done it absolutely brilliant again. As I say, you're the thinking man's Graham Norton. And thanks to and thanks to Gary and Stephen for their insights and knowledge. It's been, you know, as I say, it's like having a few quiet beers in a beer garden in summer, chatting about football with a group of mates. Loved every second of it. Thank you so much.
I think doing one in a beer garden, it might actually be the way to go in the summer. If we could meet up and do it in a beer garden, that's not a bad shout. But anyway,
we're gonna get rid of perishing snow first, guys.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, all that's left is to thank the listeners. Hope you've enjoyed it. You know, and this has been the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Please join us again next time. Thank you.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.